possible by listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, baby bonus. A New York senator proposes a $1,000 baby bonus to help people afford to have children. Payments for newborns have reduced poverty elsewhere, but are a novel idea in New York. We'll learn more from New York Focus reporter Julia Rock. The time has come to lower interest rates. That's what Fed Chair Jerome Powell said Friday. We'll get local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. Plus, new leadership at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center. And we meet the husband and wife team known as the Schuberg Duo. They're playing a very special benefit piano recital for Radio Catskill this Thursday evening. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel and Hezbollah, based in Lebanon, exchanged some of the heaviest fire yesterday since the war in Gaza started last year. Hezbollah is a proxy of Iran, and Iran has been vowing revenge for the assassinations of a Hezbollah and Hamas leader. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi says there were heightened tensions yesterday.
When the Israeli military said it had launched a major attack in southern Lebanon yesterday, many in Israel believed that it was the beginning of that wider war. Israel called it a preemptive attack because it says it got intelligence that Hezbollah was going to strike first. Hezbollah responded with its own set of rockets and drones. But then by late morning, Hezbollah said it had finished its operations for the day, and Israel de-escalated as well.
NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reporting. There's no strike or lockout this morning at Canadian National Railways. Canadian government authorities ordered two rail lines and workers to binding arbitration. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, a rail stoppage would have left billions of dollars of goods bound for the U.S. in limbo.
About 9,300 workers at Canadian National and Canadian Pacific Kansas City Railways have been ordered to return to work. The Industrial Relations Board says it will extend the previous collective agreement until a new one comes into effect. The Teamsters Canada Rail Conference says it's disappointed in the ruling and in the government for referring the dispute to arbitration, calling it cowardly and a blow for workers' rights. But experts agree that any prolonged strike could have a serious effect on the Canadian economy, with losses piling up in excess of $300 million a day, and might even have thrown the country into a recession. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Former President Donald Trump has laid a wreath at Arlington National Cemetery. This comes on today's third anniversary of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. 13 U.S. troops were killed in the chaotic departure. President Biden and Vice President Harris have released statements about the U.S. effort. Both cited the service personnel who were killed, but also point to the 2,461 U.S. troops killed during the entirety of the Afghan war. That included during Trump's presidency. Stocks open mixed this morning as a proposed supermarket merger gets checked out in federal court. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow was up about 200 points.
A federal judge in Oregon is weighing the proposed combination of Kroger and Albertsons in what would be the largest supermarket merger in U.S. history. The Federal Trade Commission is trying to block the deal, arguing it would hurt competition and lead to higher grocery prices. New orders for long-lasting manufactured goods rebounded last month after falling the month before. Durable goods orders jumped nearly 10% in July, with volatile orders for commercial aircraft accounting for most of that increase. Crude oil prices climbed over the weekend as Israel and Hezbollah traded fire. Retail gasoline prices, however, continue to fall. Gas prices are down about 47 cents a gallon from this time last year, ahead of what's expected to be a busy Labor Day travel weekend. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Officials in Ukraine say Russia launched a massive attack against it today. Ukraine says Russia fired dozens of missiles and drones and killed at least three people. The main target was Ukraine's energy infrastructure. A New York Yankees jersey worn by Babe Ruth during a World Series game in the 1930s has sold at auction for more than $24 million. As NPR's Emma Bowman reports, the winning bid set a record for sports memorabilia.
The gray road jersey is said to have been worn by Ruth when he, quote, called his shot during a 1932 World Series game against the Chicago Cubs. Video from that day shows Ruth pointing to the outfield, perhaps indicating where he would sink his homer, moments before he hit the ball far over the fence. Another telling has it that Ruth was returning the taunts from the Cubs' dugout. Sports journalist Joe Posnanski told NPR last year that what really happened remained a mystery.
Everybody has a completely different opinion about what happened, and I just love that so much. So much of baseball to me is mythology, and there's no play that has more mythology than the called shot.
Ruth himself had repeated different versions of the event. Emma Bowman, NPR News.
The Boston Red Sox and the Toronto Blue Jays will resume a delayed game today, but Boston has a new player. 2 months ago, Danny Jansen was at bat for his then-team Toronto when that game was called for rain. Jansen has since been traded to Boston, and he will play for them when the Boston-Toronto game resumes today. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This month, more than a million New Yorkers with children are receiving checks in the mail from the state. The payments of up to $330 are a one-time supplement to the state's child tax credit passed as part of the state budget negotiated by the legislature and Governor Kathy Hochul this spring. But one Albany-area Republican senator wants the state to go further and permanently give all new parents a $1,000 baby bonus. Affordability and child poverty are pressing matters for state lawmakers and the governor, even if they've done little in recent legislative sessions to tackle key drivers of rising costs, such as housing. People with young children move out of New York at higher rates than other New Yorkers because they can't afford the costs of raising a family. And almost 19% of children in the state live in poverty, one of the highest rates in the nation. New York Focus reporter Julia Rock spoke to Jason Dole about it last week.
I want to talk about this new proposal, but before we get into it, can you explain to me the existing child tax credit in New York State?
So right now, low and middle income parents in New York State, which is about 1.2 million people who qualified in that category last year, get a tax credit of up to $330 if they have a kid under the age of 17. So it's a somewhat limited child tax credit. The poorest families, people who make less than $10,000 a year, can't get the full credit. And then people who are wealthier also can't get the credit. So it's limited to a sort of small subset of parents, and the maximum amount is $330 a year.
So now this new proposal is coming from Albany area Republican State Senator Jake Ashby. What is he proposing and why?
Yeah, so Jake Ashby is proposing something that's actually quite a bit different. First, in that it would go to all parents, not just, you know, parents who make a certain amount of money. So it would be all parents of newborns in New York State, so people who'd had a baby in the last year, and the tax credit or the baby bonus would be for $1,000. So his idea behind it is that, you know, he's hearing from a lot of people who say they can't afford to start families, and he wants, you know, this $1,000 payment to parents to help offset the costs a little bit of having a baby. Often it's the case that when people have a newborn child, they're away from work for a period of time, and they also have all of these new expenses associated with the baby. So it can be a really difficult time, you know, for in people's lives. And the idea is that this $1,000 tax credit would sort of offset that difficulty a little bit.
So de facto, having a baby means you've got a lot more costs immediately, and you necessarily have less income coming in. So that's kind of the big picture behind this.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, there are some things, some ways you're supported. So if you have a job, you might be able to get paid leave when you have a baby, but that only replaces 2/3 of your income. So you're still experiencing an income drop. And if you don't have a job, or you've recently switched jobs, or for any other reason, you might not be able to get that paid family leave. So it can be a really difficult time.
Now, you spoke to Joshua McCabe, who's the director of social policy for the Niskanen Center. That's a center-right think tank. And I thought this take was interesting because he was kind of cautioning that how this proposal and proposals like this are framed might have an impact on their success. Basically saying, is it a poverty reduction measure? Is it paid leave? Or is it broad family support? Can you talk a little bit about the nuances of that presentation and how different parties might react to it?
Yeah, absolutely. The person I spoke with you mentioned is from a sort of conservative think tank in the sense that they're sort of very pro-family and they back policies that they see as sort of supporting families. And the point that McCabe was making is if New York lawmakers present this baby bonus or this $1,000 payment to parents as an anti-poverty measure, then it's going to open a big political fight over, you know, what the income cutoff should be for people to get it. So often anti-poverty measures are really restricted by income and maybe other characteristics. And he was saying if lawmakers present this as like a paid leave measure, then there might be a big legislative fight over whether to attach work requirements to it or, you know, how much should you have to work to be eligible for this. And he was sort of saying if this is just proposed as a baby bonus, something that everybody gets when they have a baby, it can sort of build more support because more people will be getting it. So, you know, there will necessarily be like a bigger constituency. And then it won't open up, you know, these battles about how to restrict it in all sorts of ways. And the senator who proposed it, as you'd mentioned earlier in the call, is a Republican. And he's definitely coming at it, you know, in my conversations with him and what he said to the press from sort of he wants it to be more affordable for people to start families standpoint, not necessarily just, you know, I'm proposing this as a way to cut poverty for new families.
While we're talking about the political traps that issues fall into, you know, one of those is abortion, family planning, things like that. The political divide on that is there's people that are opposed to abortion. And then those who are in favor of choice often say, well, the folks that are opposed to abortion aren't really trying to support people and give people what they need if they're going to have a family and not addressing those issues. This seems to totally buck those political stereotypes.
Totally. One thing that's been interesting across the country, a little bit less so, although maybe we're going to start seeing it more with proposals like this, but in the wake of the Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade and abortion restrictions, you know, in states across the country, there have been some states that are both restricting abortion access and also proposing new tax credits or payments for people with children. You know, it's obviously not happening across the board. There are plenty of states that are restricting access and not doing anything, you know, to support new families. But there's been a little bit of a shift where some, you know, anti-abortion, especially Republicans, have been supporting more policies like the one we're seeing from Ashby that provide a little bit more financial support to new families.
Yeah, I mean, that's your subhead here is that this is a new idea in New York, but they've done things like this in other places. Can you give us any more detail on any of those other places that have done something that closely matches what Ashby is proposing?
Totally. So there have been proposals at the federal level where there's also a child tax credit to do something like this, where, you know, there's a child tax credit across ages, but a much bigger credit for newborn children. Some countries have introduced and you know, implemented over many years, something like a baby bonus, like Australia did this back in 2004 when they were concerned about falling birth rates. And one thing researchers found there was that it actually had a really big anti-poverty effect, even though it didn't really increase birth rates. In Flint, Michigan now, parents of newborns get a bonus a payment when they have a newborn baby. And Baltimore is supposed to be voting on a ballot initiative this fall for a $1,000 payment to newborns, although there's been a little bit of a legal fight over that measure.
And, you know, it should be noted here, too, we're in the midst of a presidential election. And at the federal level, Vice President Kamala Harris, running as the Democratic nominee, is calling for an expanded child tax credit of up to $6,000 for families with newborns. So that's an interesting thing, again, like happening across the aisle at the federal and state level. The Democratic nominee for president is proposing this at that level. At the same time, like a Republican senator in New York is proposing a $1,000 bonus.
Totally. And, you know, one thing that did happen was during the earlier parts of the COVID pandemic, there was a big expansion in the federal child tax credit, and it immediately slashed child poverty across the country. So there was this sort of real life experiment, as it were, of what happens when you send a little bit of extra cash to new families. And, you know, many people were able to see in real time how dramatic that effect could be.
Here's where we should just take a moment to talk about the reality of child poverty in America and in New York State. One of the things I like about New York Focus is when you look at these articles, you often have graphic representations of the stats and numbers and facts behind things. And you have graphical representation of the cities with the highest child poverty. And the top two are Syracuse and Rochester. And when I first saw this graph, I assumed it was for New York State. But this is the American cities with the highest child poverty rates. New York has three major cities on the top 10 out of the whole country, including the number one and two spots with Syracuse and Rochester.
Yeah, child poverty has been a huge and persistent problem in New York. I think statewide, about 20% of kids have been living in poverty in New York for the past couple of decades. That number hasn't really budged here, even though in other states across the country, the trend in the past couple of decades has been that child poverty is falling. And you're right that, you know, poverty levels are high in parts of New York City, like the Bronx, but it's really the upstate cities, Syracuse, Rochester, and Buffalo, that see sort of astonishing rates that have not budged in a long time. And actually, when Hochul, right when she came into office, she signed a law that had been passed by the legislature to cut child poverty in half by 2030. So obviously we're sort of well on our way to 2030 at this point, but there's a state advisory council right now that has been tasked with coming up with different proposals for, you know, what the legislature could do to get the state to that goal of cutting child poverty in half. So I think it's something we're really going to expect to see, you know, a lot more discussion about in the upcoming budget sessions as the state figures out how it might finally do something about this.
Is that the Child Poverty Reduction Advisory Council?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's the response from them to Ashby's proposal?
Yes. So I spoke with one member of the council who was saying that, well, they haven't really looked at doing like a totally separate payment to new families. They have looked at sort of expanding the existing child credit that New York has to provide a bigger payment to new families. So it sounds like it's something they've looked at. I don't know, you know, what their final recommendations are going to look like in terms of tax credits, but I think that, you know, from my past reporting, my understanding from people on the council has been that they expect some type of child tax credit or family tax credit expansion to be part of their recommendations.
Along those lines, are there other ideas out there that people have been looking at the state level, you know, with this advisory council, with the stated goals of the governor? There's a lot of progress to be made before 2030, but has anything been done?
It's a great question. There's a lot of progress to be made. One thing that researchers have found has reduced poverty a little bit in New York was actually increases to the minimum wage that were passed, I think, 2 years ago now. That has a big impact on poverty. Another thing I know the council is looking closely at in various forms is housing. Obviously, that is one of the biggest costs for many families and, you know, is part of the reason people struggle so much to afford living in New York. So I think figuring out different housing proposals that might help tackle this issue is part of what they're looking at, as well as childcare. Anybody, you know, in New York and probably across the country with a kid knows that childcare is become very expensive. And so I think figuring out how to make that more affordable is also something they're looking at.
In terms of Senator Ashby's proposal, as it is on the table right now, what are you looking for to happen next? What are you keeping an eye on?
Yeah, I think I'm definitely curious to see if any of the things that this expert McCabe had talked about are going to happen. You know, are people going to try to means test it, attach work requirements to it? I think the other thing we could, you know, maybe expect to happen or at least have an eye out for is whether this is sort of folded into existing proposals. There, Senator Andrew Gonardes has worked a lot on pushing to expand and reform the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit. So maybe something like this newborn payment would be folded into that. So I think it's sort of a question of how people, you know, do people support the idea of having a payment that goes to every parent, regardless of whether they work and what their income is? And are we going to see sort of an adjustment to existing credits to provide a little bit more support to parents with younger children?
That's New York Focus reporter Julia Rock speaking to Jason Dole. New York Focus is the nonprofit news organization that produces investigative journalism covering New York State politics and policy, and we partner with them to bring you their reporting. Find more at nysfocus.com. We'll take a break, and when we come back, the new leadership at Hurleyville Performing Arts Center, and two of them are here now, live in studio. We'll talk to them next.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast, a newly renovated farmhouse that sleeps four with full gourmet cooked breakfast provided daily, located near the top of Hauk Mountain Road in the town of Walton. More information at greatwesterncatskills.com.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The mission of the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center is to, quote, celebrate the human spirit through dance, art, film, food, and events by engaging artists and people of all ages and cultures in the experience of movement and creative expression, cultivating connection and community in the Catskills. I think I got that right. I'll find out with the new chief executive officer from the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center and the new director of operations. It's Christina Antizzo and Lourdesa Hunt, who are joining us live in studio. Hello.
Good morning.
How are you guys?
Thank you for having us. We're good.
Yeah, Christina, I mean, you've been in the role for a couple of months now, but relatively new and first time here.
Yes.
Welcome. Tell folks a little bit about your background and what you're bringing to Hurleyville Performing Arts Center.
Yes, thank you. So I am actually a Sullivan County native, but I moved away right after high school and lived in Atlanta for 25 years and then came back. And so I'm super excited. I have a really extensive background in human resources. And so I started at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center as a senior director and then kind of have moved up and was actually just appointed their CEO on August 1st.
Yeah, congratulations. Thank you. Lourdesa, you just started, what, last week?
Yes, last week. Monday was my very first day as director of development, actually, at the Arts Center. It's been an exciting week. Lots of stuff to jump into, learning the programs, the many, many programs that they have going on that impact the community, and excited to be a part of those.
Hurleyville Performing Arts Center, known for lots of different programs. As I mentioned in the introduction, you know, that's the mission is to connect through all these different forms of creativity. What are some of the things that you're looking to do as the new CEO at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center?
To create more programming, not just for adults, but for children as well. Free programming, you know, not everything has to cost something. So myself and the staff have taken on a lot of these new programs that we're implementing and we're running them ourselves.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of those children's programs, especially like a focus of yours here. What are some of the new kids programs?
So what we're doing is we have three new kids programs that are starting. So we have Books with Buddies. So that'll be a story hour. You can come in, bring your children in. We provide snacks and juice boxes, and they get to make some friends, you know, when they're not in school yet. Another program that we have is a music class. So there'll be lots of instruments. They can come learn to play the instruments, maybe not necessarily learn how to play a song, but they'll learn responsibility, the colors, the types of instruments and stuff. And then we have our Twist and Shout Thursdays, which is basically a dance that kids can come in, get their little wiggles out, have some fun, and get some of that energy out. And parents, and again, snacks and drinks are provided.
And parents who are listening will appreciate that.
Yes.
Get your wiggles out.
Get them out.
And you have a couple of festivals that you're closing out the season with as well. And a lot of you guys have been known for having these different types of cultural festivals. And is that going to be a still continuing key aspect of your leadership under at the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center?
100%. So when I started, one of the things that I noticed is the demographic of the Latin community. So this year we decided that we're going to do a Latin festival so we can incorporate all of their heritage. And the reason it is on September 14th is because that's what kicks off Latin Heritage Month.
Right.
So we want to kind of kick it off with a bang.
So that's coming up September 14th. What are some of the things that folks can experience there?
So we're going to have some different performers, from musicians, Latin vendors, Latin dancers, Latin food trucks. So anything that you can think of Latin related, we're going to have it there.
And then the other event that's happening?
Yeah, we have our Harvest Festival, which will be October 5th from 12 to 4. And then after that Harvest Festival, we'll do a nighttime outdoor movie.
And another thing I noticed on the calendar, too, the Alive Again for Veterans. Can you talk about that collaboration that you've got going on?
So that is a partnership with ATI and with the STEAM Fund. And so they are partnering with, they have some amazing guests that are going to be coming, and it's open to all veterans and their families, first responders. So it'll be October 19th. Food will be provided, breakfast, lunch, some great guest speakers. So it'll be really great.
And another thing I noticed that you do at HPAC is a sensory friendly movie and other sensory friendly events for children. Can you talk a little bit about that and why that's important?
Yeah, 100%. So we live in a community where you have the Center for Discovery, you have New Hope, you have ARC. So making sure that it is accommodating to everybody in the county, we have these sensory movies so you can bring your children. The lights are turned up. They're able to get up and dance around, shout, make noise during the movie, and everybody is understanding that nobody's going to get mad about it.
And still not leaving out seniors, there's a senior cinema program as well that goes on too.
Correct. Yep. So every it is the second Thursday of every month, we do senior cinema. We do a cocktail hour afterwards. So seniors are able to purchase tickets at a discounted price. And then afterwards, we provide coffee and donuts for them to socialize afterwards, because it's really important to give seniors something to do here. You know, when they're left here and they don't go to the South like some people do, what activities do they have here and how can they get out and, you know, mingle with friends?
You had me at cocktail hour. Lourdesa, so this has been a week so far. Did you know you were getting into all this, all the different demographics, all the different programs, or is that what attracted you to the role?
It's actually what attracted me to the role. I really love to work in the community, helping people in their everyday lives, seeing that impact that small actions can have, big waves. So these programs, they may seem small, but they have larger ripples through the community, right? Bringing people together. Not only are we looking at our children, our younger children, but we're, you know, focusing on programs for middle school age, high school age. How can we touch every, you know, aspect of the community?
And you're getting feedback from community members to help with some of the programming as well.
Absolutely. Some of the Mommy and Me classes, one of the features that we had added in is that some of those programs are going to be at night, because a lot of programming is during the day for that younger demographic. Yes, those children aren't in school, but parents are working or they have things to do. So there is a component of those groups that are at night. One section is during the day, and then there's a second weekend that will be at night, so it's accessible to everybody.
Where can folks learn more or perhaps get involved?
Yeah, definitely. So follow us on social. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and sign up for our newsletter at hpacny.org.
All right. Thank you both for coming in. Christina Antizzo is the Chief Executive Officer of Hurleyville Performing Arts Center, and Lourdesa Hunt is the Director of Development. One week in. Thanks
One week in.
Thank you guys for coming by.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps is One Small Step, and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
I'm Elena Moore, and this election season, make a big impact on your community by putting a big hole in your garage where that unused vehicle is collecting dust. Donating your car, truck, or other vehicle is one way to help sustain public radio in your community. When you fill in your ballot this November, you'll know that your donated vehicle helped keep voters informed. Here's how to get started.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and every Monday we hear from James B. Huntington for Local Economic Perspective, local economist and author. James B. Huntington joins us now live. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Well, James B., It's finally come. Not the actual interest rate cut, but Fed Reserve Chair Powell saying the time has come. What's happened, according to Federal Reserve Chair Powell, about interest rate cuts?
Well, he showed his hand, although it was expected that there would be an interest rate cut. It was obvious, really. Now it looks like it could be more. There's a good chance there was some talk about a nominal 0.25%, and it could be half or even 3/4 now. We don't know yet. He doesn't either, because there's still a jobs report coming out between now and the September 18th date when they would announce it, and there's an inflation reading. So we don't know. I mean, it could be much bigger. It could easily be at least 3/4. I mean, nobody's saying that, but we don't know what these reports will say. And unemployment has gone up for 3 straight months, and we have this adjustment of 800 and some thousand jobs subtracted. So we haven't had as many new jobs as were thought. So, but he said the time has come for policy to adjust. That's good news. Really, what happened was that inflation was dropping, but it wasn't as low as he wanted. And even though unemployment was going up, the Fed was holding out for even lower inflation, but now it's reaching a possible danger point or something where it's making a bigger difference, that unemployment has gone up actually about 1% in a few years here. That's not very good. So it's clear that we're going to have something, and what it is, we don't know, and they don't know either.
We'll have to keep an eye on it. So the headline in the Seattle Times about Starbucks is that Starbucks' new CEO faces a venti-sized turnaround challenge. They named a new CEO from Chipotle. What's going on at Starbucks?
Well, there was a contributed essay in the New York Times last week, and the title of that really was, "There are a bazillion possible Starbucks orders, and it's killing the company." They're saying that an example, something that happens to customers there, which is frustrating, there's nothing they can do about it, is you're already in line at Starbucks, and that dude who's looking down, not at a cell phone, but at the post-it note that holds the orders of his office mates, has 6 different kinds of coffee with many, many combinations. I'll read this what he wrote there, each of which involves some combination of tall, venti, grand, double pump, one to four shots of espresso, half calf, oat milk, non-fat milk, soy milk, milk, whipped cream, syrup, brown sugar, white sugar, no sugar, and mocha drizzle from the Pike Physician with 2.5 twists.
Yeah.
So they're saying there are, at the lowest viewpoint, there are 170,000 possible drink combinations. But if you look at it another way, figure it differently with more combinations, it could be 300 billion. And the degree of difficulty is worse. The article here cites as a counterexample In-N-Out Burgers, where they say all they have is hamburgers and fries and shakes and other drinks. But the thing here going on is when you order a hamburger, you can often choose what goes on it. The customer gets out of the way, gets out of line, whereas a lot of these things in Starbucks, the employees are making them together, are making them totally. So that's causing real problems because it's consuming time and it's making worse, at least by this essayist's perception, that there's always one fewer employee than needed, unless you're at an airport, in which there are generally four fewer employees than needed.
Yeah, a big turnaround there that they're going to have to tackle. He's going to have to tackle. Let's talk about another couple of big retailers, Target and Walmart. What are they doing to try to increase their sales and attract shoppers?
Apparently, they've already done it. They've cut prices in various ways. Target, over the last few months, cut prices on 5,000 frequently purchased items in many markets, may not all. And Walmart did the same for 7,200. The problem is that they've known that customers are pulling back and sales have been dropping or not increasing to the extent they want to. So unless they like the results, and they may well, these are being described as rollbacks, known in the industry as a temporary price cut, but it's very possible they'll keep them. I mean, and the smart money is saying, say that McDonald's is going to hang on to its discount plan indefinitely because the customers have liked it a lot, and they seem to need something like that, and they'll still make money on other things or make more money on other things. So maybe lower prices out there if you haven't been to these stores for a while.
Another thing to squeeze in before we leave, about you said something about Disney and the theme park vacations, really expensive for folks. What's the problem now with going to a Disney theme park? Not having enough money, I would say.
Yes, that's the problem. We have an estimated cost, according to one analyst, that a family of four taking a one-week trip to Disney is going to pay between $6,500 and $15,600.
Wow.
Not including flights or souvenirs.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's getting way, way up there. It's like long since into three figures just to get per person to get into get park admission. So it's getting to be an expensive thing. And you're talking about people who describe themselves as upper middle class, quite prosperous, or having to borrow money to pay for these things. Some of them think it's mandatory for children. And another issue they don't mention in this story, but I read an unofficial guide. It was a very good way of handling a trip to Disney with advice you wouldn't get from the company. And one thing they repeatedly said is that children who are too young are not going to appreciate the trip at all. And among average six-year-olds going to Disney, they're saying their favorite thing about their vacation was the motel pool. And they're not going to remember these things. And yet in this piece, you have 3- and 4-year-olds going to there. Very often tends to overwhelm children that young. So I have to advise to research this stuff and find out if you really know what you're doing before taking very small children. That's really sort of more for the parents than it is for the children to go out there when they're too young to appreciate it. So between that and the cost, you can get some awfully lavish foreign vacations for over $10,000 for a family of four. So that's the kind of thing you're passing up if you're choosing to go to Disney. So think it over and check it out.
You could go to Italy itself instead of Italy at Epcot at those prices.
You could go to Italy itself for much less than what the trip at Disney costs. Oh, it's not even the same.
All right, let's talk about the numbers. What were the stock, oil, precious metal prices doing this morning, and how did things change?
Over the past week, ending early this morning, gold, $25.24 per ounce. That's up 23. That's $7 from an all-time high as of this morning. Silver, $30.03. That's up $1.12. That's more, with the ratio being 84-1, which is still high. I'd say silver is still undervalued in comparison to gold. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 41,175 plus 515 on the week. That's within 20 points of another all-time high, which it reached at one point last week. NASDAQ, 17,878, gained 246 on the week. That's a higher proportion there. It's not as close to an all-time high, but it's still less than 800 away. We could very easily see that within the month if it breaks well. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $75.65, the 42-gallon barrel. That's down 56 cents. Not much, but it does count. Bitcoin, $63,703, up just over 5,000. Still a relative strength, but it's in the 60s. It was in the 60s for a long time, and it's a ways from its high. It's probably 9,000, but it's still gained substantially. British pound, $1.32.08, up 2.34 cents. That's the highest in years. That's because some clown said that it had a maximum of $1.30 a week or two ago, and they got what they deserved.
Oh, gosh.
The euro, $1.11.75, up almost 1.5 cents. That may be continuing to be strong. It's been at least months since it's been that high. And the Japanese 100 yen, 69 cents, rather. That's up a penny. That's looking better now. So overall, this was a perfect week. Everything went up except oil went down. So everything went in the good direction.
That's
so
good news.
Congratulations, everyone.
We did it. All right, James B., you deserve a break. We'll take off Labor Day, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we meet the husband and wife musicians known as the Schuberg Duo. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl, and the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. This Wednesday, August 28th, there's a very special benefit concert for Radio Catskill. It's an evening of four-hand piano music performed by Miles Fellenberg and Alice Shenang Shu of the Schuberg Duo. Our own classical kit spoke to Miles and Alice.
Good morning. I'm here with Miles Fellenberg and Alice Shu, who together are the Schuberg Piano Duo. Well, good morning, guys.
Good morning, kid.
So glad you could take the time to talk with me this morning. You know, there's lots of piano repertoire for two pianos, but there's not so much repertoire for what you're doing because you're not playing on two pianos. You're playing together on one piano, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, there's kind of two streams throughout history of the two piano repertoire, which tends to be either serious concert music, for instance, a Rachmaninoff suite, or
Wizard of Oz.
But the four hands repertoire is historically kind of grew out of the home. And, you know, back in the day when everyone used to have a piano and people gathered around for entertainment, people would read various dances of Schubert and Brahms, as well as opera overtures and symphonic music transcriptions became really popular, particularly before recordings. They go to a concert and hear a great Beethoven overture and then wanted to go home and reproduce it. So it has a very interesting kind of lineage.
Oh, that's interesting because, I mean, I knew, you know, well, going back to my own childhood, we had a piano and it seemed like everybody that could afford to get a piano and you could get a spinet, you know, that wasn't huge. Ours was in our dining room and that was your entertainment. Mm-hmm. That was the form of entertainment and people would sing and, you know, well, mom or dad or somebody played the piano and so many kids had piano lessons. But I didn't realize that a lot of those transcriptions were done for four hands, not just for two. And that's interesting. So there is more of a repertoire than I expected, but we don't really hear it in concert that much anymore.
That's right. That's right.
Yes, because originally these four hands reps, they were really intended for home entertainment, and then there were home salons, and you know Schubert used to do those Schubertiads. Where people gather at his house, and then they do exactly what you just said. People get together, they sing, they play the piano. So it's more for a smaller scale of audience, which is perfect for this concert.
Well, yes, because, I mean, one of the reasons I'm speaking to you today is because the two of you are going to be giving a concert that's actually a benefit for WJFF Radio Catskill at the Meyerson-Scheindlin home in Bethel. You know, so it is going to be like a salon as they had so often back in the time when, you know, everybody seemed to have a piano. So
that's right. So, yeah, it's really exciting for us to be able to continue that tradition.
Well, that's wonderful. And, you know, I'm looking at the program that you're going to be playing, and it's such a festive program. I mean, first of all, you're going to be doing the overture to A Midsummer Night's Dream, and having danced in that ballet, I can tell you that every time I hear that, it's like I get this sense of anticipation and excitement knowing that something wonderful is coming. So starting with that is just wonderful. And then, you're going to be doing Ravel, and you're going to be doing, I think, like the main course, which is after the intermission, is going to be the Scheherazade suite of Rimsky-Korsakov. But before the intermission, you're doing something by William Hertz, The Wizard of Oz Fantasy, which uses the themes composed by Harold Arlen and Herbert Stothart for that film. And I've never heard of William Hertz, and I wasn't aware of that piece of music. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I wasn't aware of this until about a year ago either. I was doing a concert in Texas with a good friend of mine, Scott Cuellar, also a pianist. And his teacher, his former teacher, from Rice University is friends with the composer William Hertz. And so this was introduced to my friend's teacher, and he performs it regularly, both as a solo version and as a four-hands version. And then Scott and I got to play this in Texas, and we thought that it would fit really well with this theme of kind of magic and distant lands. I mean, in this case, the distant land is Kansas. but certainly it's magical and, you know, has all of the great themes. I mean, it has Over the Rainbow, of course. We're off to see the wizard. Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. and a few others. So it's a really well-written, fun fantasy.
Well, that sounds like it is going to be fun. You know, thinking about the difference between two pianos and four hands, it occurs to me that when there are four hands on the piano, it must be very tricky creating transcriptions, because when you've got two pianos, there are going to be parts in it where you're both playing the same note on two pianos. But for four hands, you can't do that, obviously. I'm wondering, if you were going to create an arrangement yourselves, would the fact that you have to be playing different notes from each other at all times, would that impact the kind of thing that you would choose to transcribe?
Yeah, certainly. There's the difficulties, of course, in physical coordination. And, you know, it helps for us to be a husband-wife duo, so that we're not so concerned about bumping into each other or hands grazing.
Right, right.
But there's certainly many challenges. I mean, even writing for piano alone, it's difficult for composers that are not pianists, or at least have not had a lot of time with piano, playing piano. But four hands in particular, a lot of coordination difficulties. So I think when it comes to the orchestral repertoire, a lot of the things that other composers consider, and we would also consider as we choose to arrange and transcribe different pieces, is whether the orchestral color and timbre would translate well onto the piano.
Uh-huh.
And we're still, you know, in the learning process of this, and we've been surprised by some of these pieces, which are known for their orchestration. For instance, Scheherazade, we at first didn't think it would work well just hearing the sound of the piano for 40 minutes. But there's something about stripping away the orchestral color that allows the listeners and us to get a deeper look at the score, in a way.
And more clarity.
Yeah, so much more clarity than can be heard, you know, from 80 people on stage.
Exactly. Yeah, well, it can kind of transform it for the listener, right? It's like, I mean, you recognize it, but it's also like hearing a brand new work.
That's right. And the three pieces, Mendelssohn Overture, Ravel Rhapsody Espagnol, and Rimsky-Korsakov Scheherazade, they wrote it themselves for four hands. So these are their own arrangements.
Oh.
In some of these cases, they wrote the four hands first and then later orchestrated it. And in other cases, they wanted to create a four hands version, perhaps to be played by themselves and their friends at home. So these are particularly interesting versions because it doesn't go through a third person, or I guess a second person in this case.
Right.
Well,
yeah, and then the great thing about four hands as opposed to two pianos is that in some ways it's much more unified because it's two people sitting at one piano. So when we do arrange or transcribe music, in some ways it's personally, I think it's a little easier just because we can try things immediately and everything is a little more immediate in terms of physical coordination or how the sound, collective sound would be like because we're sitting at one piano.
Right.
And even visually, it also looks more unified just because, you know, you're a team on one piano as opposed to two people sitting at two pianos kind of far from each other.
Well, I did attend a four hands concert one time where they actually had a camera so that the audience could see the keyboard. And it was fascinating just to see that coordination of, you know, who was where at each moment on the keyboard.
Right. It's like having 20 little dancers.
Yes. Exactly. Well, this sounds like it's going to be a wonderful concert. I will say there, because it is a salon type concert, there will be limited seating. You know, I encourage people to go to WJFFradio.org to purchase tickets for this concert, because I think it's going to just be a delightful way to spend a Wednesday evening. It's going to be August 28th, which is a Wednesday, and in Bethel. And it sounds wonderful. One more thing I just want to ask before I let you go. You know, I've interviewed a lot of couples who are musicians, and often they do wind up playing together, you know, in a string quartet or whatever. And I'm wondering about the challenges and rewards of being a two-musician couple. I know that you're both working on your doctorates, correct? And
yeah.
And obviously you needed to be doing that at the same place. I believe you were just at a festival in Italy. And so is it easier or is it challenging to make sure that you can be together? Because some couples I've talked to, they don't get to see each other that often because they're, you know, booked in different places. But since you're doing four hands piano, does that make it easier for you to be together as a couple?
Yeah, in some ways it does, and in some ways it doesn't, because we each also do our own things aside from this, teaching at different schools and playing with instrumentalists and solo and chamber music. Definitely one of the challenges is that we play the same instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So as our friends joke about with us, they say we have a redundant skill set.
Yeah.
So it does get difficult when it comes time to apply for jobs or even music festivals. And we've been recently very lucky and grateful that we've been able to do many things together. We were just in Italy teaching and performing at a music festival there for a couple weeks. In about a week, we'll be off to Annapolis, Maryland, to participate in the Annapolis Chamber Music Festival there. So we'll be performing actually only one piece together. Most of our stuff will be with our colleagues. So it's hard, but particularly rewarding when we can find those opportunities to travel and play together.
And I think the biggest reward for me is that when we do get to work together, play together or teach together, we get to talk about it and discuss it afterwards. And there is nothing better than to, you know, talk to someone and get feedback and bounce your ideas off of another person who, you know, understands you deeply from a personal level and a musical level.
Well, that is delightful. And I'm really looking forward to hearing Schuberg Piano Duo at the Meyerson Scheinlin Home in Bethel on Wednesday, August 28th at 7:00. And if you would like to be there too, go to wjffradio.org where you can purchase a ticket. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me this morning. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for meeting with us, Mimi. It was a pleasure.
Yeah,
we look forward to meeting you in person. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, great. Well, thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
Concert with the Schuberg Duo is on Wednesday, the 28th. There are just a few seats available, so grab those tickets at wjffradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can hear this show and all of our local programming at the website wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Chatskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
it's another music yard sale. Happening 9 to 3 this Saturday at Radio Catskill and Liberty. Records, CDs, cassettes, turntables, stereos. It's all priced to move, so bring a big vehicle and load up. The Music Yard Sale, 9 to 3 Saturday at Radio Catskill and Liberty. See you there.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, sun followed by some clouds and a thunderstorm in spots this afternoon. High near 80, air quality is fair. Tonight, clear with a low of 56. And tomorrow, partly sunny, may see a thunderstorm pop up in the afternoon as well. High 83. It's 11 o'clock.